All week we've been talking about the opioid crisis and how people across the U.S. and in Illinois are dying from drug overdoses at record rates. Today we ask, what can be done to prevent more unnecessary deaths?
We need something that can galvanize the conversation in a way that people go from saying individuals with opioid misuse disorders should be shunned and stigmatized to saying, huh, they're our friends and neighbors. We need to bring them into the fold and help them.
Dr. Nirav Shah, director of Illinois' Department of Public Health, joins us. Plus, we also speak with Republican Congressman Randy Holkgren of Illinois' 14th District about this opioid issue and hear his thoughts on whether an independent investigation into President Trump's ties with Russia is warranted.
I want answers. I want to get the truth. I want to get to the bottom of this.
Plus, the ongoing baseball rivalry between the Cubs and the Cardinals. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. All this week we've been learning about opioid addiction, which claims the lives of more than 90 people every day. That's according to the CDC. And recently, Illinois was identified as one of 19 states where drug overdose death rates are rising. All the while, access to service has been getting more difficult for many people to come by, as you've been hearing all week. We've been talking about the result of steady declines in state funding for addiction treatment and mental health services. That's been happening over the past decade, made worse, of course, by the two-year-long budget impasse. Yesterday, I had a chance to speak with Congressman Randy Holkgren. He's a Republican representing the 14th Congressional District in Northern Illinois, and Dr. Nirav Shah, director of Illinois' Department of Public Health, to learn more about efforts they've been making to address this issue. Dr. Shah, welcome back to the 21st. I appreciate you taking the time.
It's great to be with you.
What has the Illinois Department of Public Health been doing to respond to the opioid crisis in Illinois?
Well, our agency, as well as the other executive branch agencies where the opioid crisis has affected, have been doing a number of things. For years now, each of these agencies has been addressing this crisis in their own way. At the Department of Public Health, for example, we are the record keeper and the data storage and collection arm for a lot of these things. So we've been tracking these deaths, working with other folks to try to put out a prevention-based message and really take a public health approach to the crisis. Other state agencies, for example, the Department of Corrections, which runs what is arguably the largest mental health hospital in the state, they've been working with their inmates to determine how they can do better at managing the crisis, preparing folks who are leaving incarceration when they go back to their homes to avoid re-addiction, such things. All of these agencies have been working on the crisis for many years now, but starting a few months ago, six or so months ago, we realized that what we needed to do was come together to identify existing activities, eliminate areas of duplication, and all come together with a consistent plan and an overarching strategy. And that's what we've been doing pretty consistently now to make sure that we are working with stakeholders as well as our partners at the federal government to all march from the same playbook.
Speaking of the federal government, I'd like to bring someone else into this conversation. Congressman Randy Holkgren is a Republican. He represents the 14th Congressional District in Northern Illinois, parts of McHenry, DuPage, Kane, Will counties, and more. Congressman, thanks for taking the time to talk to us about this issue. I know this is something you've been working on for quite some time.
Thanks, Nyla. Good to be with you.
When you, I know, within the 14th District, you have been meeting and talking to people. We just heard Dr. Shah talk about sort of all of the different kind of agencies that are involved with all of this. How are you seeing your district in particular being affected by the opioid crisis in recent years?
Well, it's been tragic. It really is epidemic level as far as the number of lives that we're losing. We see increased efforts and work of people coming together, which is encouraging. But we still see a very severe problem. And talking to a lot of the people, coroners or other health departments or other folks that are representing counties in my area are still seeing way too many deaths, too many overdoses, and it just is still a huge problem. So our focus has been bringing people together, trying to make sure that we're recognizing how complex this problem is, but also that there are things that we can do, certainly helping young people working in education to let people know how dangerous this is. Just was meeting with a group up in Mundelein who are working with middle school and high school students, and seeing some real impact of students recognizing how dangerous this is, and that even just trying this could be deadly, not knowing, again, strengths of so much of this is growing and things, but also working with medical communities, other folks, hospitals, recognizing that people have a responsibility with opioids, with prescriptions, painkiller medicine, that if it falls into the wrong hands can really be damaging as well and can get someone into this really downward spiral. So
Representative Holmgren, I'm just thinking, I actually had surgery a couple months ago, and Dr. Shaw, I'd love for you to weigh in on this as well. I was shocked at how many opioids they sent me home with. They sent me home with 60 pills and said, take as many as you need. And I was kind of surprised. And I was, especially because we've had so many of these conversations. Dr. Shaw, you and I have had those. Representative Holmgren, let me start by asking you, at the federal level, there have been lots of efforts to, on that frontline effort, just in terms of doctors and prescribing for pain relief. I think there's been changes in guidelines. What do you think? Do you think more needs to be done at the federal level from a prescription standpoint for doctors and for prescribing?
Well, I do. I think the question is, you know, does it need to be legislative? Is it something, again, that within the medical community, or are there things that can be changed? Right now, some compensation is tied to ratings of doctors, and especially in addressing pain. So there is a lot of push of doctors to make sure that they're giving patients plenty of medicine to make sure that they can take care of their pain so that they're pleased with the result. And I'm grateful that we have some of these very important medicines that can be helpful, but they also, we have to recognize how dangerous they are. And like you said, you know, 60 pills, you just have to wonder, you know, that seems way too much, and it's
right.
So dangerous.
Yeah, Dr. Shaw, what's your thought? Yeah, Dr. Shaw, what are your thoughts on that in terms of, I know there's been so much discussion from both an FDA level, from a governmental level about what doctors should be doing. What's the IDEPH doing to work with doctors in terms of just even from that front line of prescribing pain medications to people, knowing that that's how most often it starts?
That's a great question. As you note, the overprescribing of opioids is one of the reasons, one of the many reasons we are where we are with this epidemic. That notion that patients who have had minor surgeries need a big bottle of pills comes from thinking that's about 20 years old. It came from a time when the teaching was that every single patient needed to have zero pain, especially after surgery. That thinking has greatly evolved over the years, and now there are much more sophisticated ways to deal with postoperative pain, as well as the notion that a little bit of pain is really not going to kill you. So what we've been doing at the department is working with doctors of all sorts. In fact, just this week, we're rolling out a web series. We worked in conjunction with every single training program in the state of Illinois. These are the programs where medical students go to become doctors after they graduate from medical school. Universities, large hospitals, residency programs, they're called. And we worked with every single one of those programs in the state of Illinois. And what those programs will now require is for all incoming trainees of any level, regardless of where they went to medical school, to go through a course that educates these new young doctors on responsible opioid prescribing. The other thing we're doing is working with the existing medical societies. As the congressman mentioned, existing doctors, and perhaps in your experience, Nyla, are, if they've been in practice for a long time, they may have been educated in this era when the notion was we got to push as many opioids as possible. And so we really have to work with existing practicing doctors to help them get comfortable with the idea that prescribing fewer than 60 Vicodin after a root canal is going to be okay. And that's a long process, but this cultural change in medicine is going to take time, but we're really working with all of these groups to get the word out.
So that's one part of the problem. The other thing that we've been talking a lot about this week has been funding. And I actually wanted to play a piece of a conversation we had a few days ago with Sarah Howe. She's the CEO of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. They represent 60 service providers across the state. And this gets specifically to Illinois' budget crisis. Here's how she explained the effects of it.
every provider that I speak with is struggling because of the state funding. There isn't a provider that I talk to anymore that is not seeing their admissions for heroin go up. At the same time, though, the total admissions to treatment are going down because of the state budget crisis. Just from 2013 to 2016, there were almost 25,000 fewer admissions to state treatment across the state for state-funded treatment, and that's a direct result of the budget crisis.
That's Sarah Howe with the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. We spoke to her earlier this week. Dr. Shaw, how is IDPH handling, how does the funding, the crisis that our state is in, how does that affect your ability as the Director of Public Health to address this problem?
Well, the state budget crisis is certainly a concern in this regard. I think it speaks for the to the need to make sure that we come to a quick resolution to this budget standoff as quickly as possible. It's clear that that all the sides, all the teams, all the players need to be at the table because of these very reasons. The the crisis has so many different moving parts, and as I mentioned earlier, there are quite a few agencies working on it. At our agency, for example, much of the work that we're doing on the opioid crisis is entirely funded or largely funded by, for example, the CDC and the Department of Human Services at the federal level. Similarly, a lot of the spending that goes toward the crisis, for example, from the Medicaid program, has been authorized and required by various court orders. I don't want to suggest that there has been no impact, but much of the work that our agency does, the Department of Corrections, the Department, various other agencies, comes at the federal level and thus has been able to continue.
As we talk about the federal level, Representative Holmgren, first I wanted to ask you just, I know you've heard from providers in Northern Illinois about insufficient funds being a barrier to helping people struggling with addiction. I wonder if you have a message for state lawmakers about the budget crisis and how that's affected social service providers throughout the state.
Well, it's been very serious. Yes, I have, even over the last week as I was back in Illinois, all over the seven counties that I represent, there's real concern and real pain, honestly, that a lot of these providers are feeling, the delay in payment, the uncertainty, and so it is a real problem, and it's something that we're seeing at a time when the need is growing, when the problem is growing, when the challenges are growing, and unfortunately, these aren't necessarily cheap fixes, of some of the beds that are necessary in care in treatment centers. Having more availability, there's not easy answers or cheap answers, but we know this works, and we know that if we don't have this treatment, we're going to lose more precious lives. And so we really do need this situation to be taken care of. We also need to keep working on the federal level and making sure that we're doing what we need to do as well, providing resources. We've passed some important legislation out here, the Comprehensive Addiction and Recovery Act, and I was a co-sponsor of that, grateful that that's law now. But and there is some funding there for inpatient addiction treatment, long-term sober living arrangements, but we need to do more. We need to make sure that these are working and that the process, working with the states, that monies are flowing, resources are flowing, and that there is great cooperation there, that it is getting to the place where it actually can make a difference in getting somebody help, that they truly can get on that road to recovery.
Congressman, you've been a supporter of the AHCA, and I wanted to ask, as we're talking about different legislation, earlier in the week we were talking to different healthcare reporter who was talking about how switching to Medicaid block grants may cap the amount of funding available to states, making it harder to address the growing need for treatment for patients who are addicted to opioids. What's your response to that?
Yeah, I'm concerned about it. It was something very much a part of my discussion as I was going through this bill. I wasn't on the committees that had to go through Energy and Commerce and Ways and Means and Budget were kind of the main focus of the committees, but all of us have been very engaged. I've been talking with providers in Illinois, with our hospitals, with our doctors, and also with leadership here and the administration to raise concern of fears that the current situation that Illinois is in, we don't want to further punish, again, the people who just need help, people who need this type of care. And so grateful for a couple of my colleagues, too, John Shimkus, who's on Energy and Commerce, and Adam Kinzinger, also were very active in working with the state, but also with leadership here, with Health and Human Services, with CMS, making sure that that's very clear of our concern of the situation that Illinois is in, that we don't want to lock in this poor condition because of, you know, some of the funding issues that Illinois has, and have gotten some good responses back from them, some assurances back. The process obviously is a long process where it's now going to the Senate. We'll see what happens, if anything happens over there, if they do anything with the bill that we've sent, or if they start over and do something completely different. But I think these discussions are really important, making sure that we are addressing not only that people can have coverage, but they can have care, that doctors will see and take what they have. We hear of situations of doctors not taking new Medicare or Medicaid patients because of the delays that they're seeing in payments and things. So we want to make sure whatever happens, whatever the final solution looks like, that it is caring for people who have pre-existing conditions, but also that we're recognizing these important treatments that are very expensive, but you can't put a price tag on a life. And so we've got to make sure that people can get access to this, and that there's coverage in the insurance that they'll have, and that they'll be not only just coverage, but places they actually can go and get the treatment that they need. So it's ongoing. It's a struggle. There's no perfect answer. Reality that some states are in much better situations than we are, and are great moving forward with this, you know, as far as block grant and things. For us, it could be really scary. So anyhow, we're going to keep working on it. We've been very engaged in it along with my colleagues, and we'll see. The process is ongoing, but hopefully we'll have some good solutions that really will provide good care along with good coverage that people can afford.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll hear more of this conversation with Congressman Randy Holkerin. He's a Republican representing the 14th Congressional District in Northern Illinois, and Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of the Illinois Department of Public Health. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, preparing students and scholars for their fields by offering access to today's cutting-edge equipment and technology within advanced library environments and facilities. The University Library at Illinois.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about Illinois' opioid crisis. Data from the Illinois Department of Public Health shows that for every age group and for every race, the number of people dying from drug overdoses is on the rise. Yesterday, we spoke with the director of the Illinois Department of Public Health, Dr. Nirav Shah. We were also joined by Congressman Randy Holkerin, a Republican representing the 14th Congressional District in Northern Illinois. Representative Holkerin, before the break, we were talking about the proposed American Health Care Act and Medicaid block grants, which would cap the amount of money available to states. That could make it harder to address the growing need for treatment for people struggling with opioid addiction. You were raising your concerns about that particular issue. That said, do you support the AHCA going forward with all of these questions that you've raised?
Well, I did support it. You know, to me, the question was, I served down in Springfield for 12 years. I've been here in Washington for six, and, you know, I've never voted on a perfect bill yet. So everything, we do the best we can where we're at right now. I think there were some important steps there. There's a lot of things that I was frustrated with, but I'm also hearing that, you know, we see so many insurance companies pulling out of exchanges. We see in three out of the seven counties that I have, they have only one insurance provider, and that provider doesn't allow them to go and see sometimes the hospital that's closest to them. They're not in that network. So there's real problems with the Affordable Care Act. It's just not doing what we thought it was going to do. It's become much more expensive than people thought. So I think this is the right step to move forward. I don't think we're done with this yet. I think it's going to be ongoing, and I want to be engaged in a part of that. So, yeah, I'm supportive of moving forward, but ultimately having real, clear, solid answers, making sure people in Illinois are treated fairly and that they can get access to coverage that they want, but also with that coverage they really can have doctors and hospitals that will accept that coverage and see them, and we're just not seeing that as we need to now.
Can I ask you, Dr. Shah, as we've been talking about We've been talking about AHCA, healthcare. I mean, there's so many different pieces of this, but I wanted to pose a question to you that I posed to the congressman. This is such a multifaceted problem, but how much emphasis do you think needs to be on prevention versus helping people who've become addicted have access to treatment?
Well, in many respects, the opioid crisis that we're facing today has strong parallels to the HIV crisis. In fact, I think it's safe to say that the opioid crisis is this generation's HIV crisis. And much like the HIV crisis, we didn't really start seeing reductions in the number of cases of HIV. We didn't start making inroads against HIV until a few things happened. The first was that all of the relevant groups started coming to the table to really focus on an agreed-upon strategic plan. The second thing was a dedicated and focused interest on prevention. And when we made those changes, we started seeing that the tide turned. And I think the opioid crisis is similar. Although treatment is necessary, it's not sufficient. We won't be able to treat our way out of the opioid crisis. The only way that we'll actually start making inroads to really get at the root cause, the genesis of this crisis, is by deflecting individuals who might otherwise become addicted from getting addicted in the first place. That is not easy. Prevention is one of the most challenging things to do in public health. But it's what we have to do. We have to focus on making sure that the young folks who might be interested in experimenting with these drugs go a different route. We have
well,
to make
and
sure
that's
that...
a really, can I stop you for a second there? Because that's such an mm-hmm. important thing. Can you talk about that for a minute? Just what studies show, the evidence shows from when, what it's like for a teenager to become addicted to opioids, how difficult it is for heroin, and when it changes mm-hmm. a teenager's body chemistry than it does for an adult?
Well, what we know about the science of addiction and the science of opioid addiction in particular is that, in general, it's a chronic disease, and that there are some folks who are more prone toward becoming addicted to opioids than others. But what we also know is that there are programs that actually can reduce the risk of long-term addiction to adolescents. There are a number of programs, for example, that focusing on the positive. So rather than making drug abuse the norm, they focus on the behaviors and stigmatizing it as a result. These sorts of programs actually focus on praising and encouraging normal behaviors that don't focus on drug abuse. These things are very difficult to do. There are school districts across the state that are using these modules, as well as across the country, but these aren't easy things. In many respects, it's always easier to throw a pill at something, but trying to avoid the root cause of the problem is far, far, far more difficult. But I am pleased to report that we are working with the Illinois school boards and the Board of Education to roll these programs out. There's a lot of interest in doing something comprehensive across the state. In the same way that the state agencies have come together to march from the same playbook, schools are starting to do the very same thing.
We've been asking our audience to weigh in on this issue, Dr. Shaw, and I wanted to play a voicemail we got from a listener in Savoy. She had a question I was hoping you could answer. Let's hear it.
My question is, what about medical marijuana as a solution to this? I think that, you know, naturally, like so many other people, we could, you know, save a lot of money and add to the tax base, and it just seems like such a great solution. And I am appalled, of course, at Governor Rauner for not immediately going to that solution.
That's Anne in Savoy who called in with that question, left it on our voicemail. Dr. Shaw, what about that? Is there research on that, medical marijuana to help prevent or help people get off heroin? Other opioids?
There is one study that has been done that has been peer-reviewed and well-validated that suggests that there might be a link between medical cannabis usage or the availability of cannabis and deaths from opioids. That is to say that higher rates of medical cannabis use might be correlated at a statewide level to lower deaths from opioids. It's an intriguing hypothesis, but right now the evidence base that supports it is just scant, it's way too early to make public policy decisions about the opioid crisis from the very, very initial data that we have. For example, while it's true that there was a link, that was only at the aggregated state level. We don't really know on an individual patient level this holds true. And as you and your listeners know, correlation does not equal causation.
That said, what do you think are some of the challenges to educating the general public on this issue?
The biggest challenge here, by far, is to remove the stigma that's associated with individuals who suffer from opioid use disorders. Again, much like HIV, in the early days of HIV, one of the biggest challenges was moving individuals from a place of misunderstanding to understanding. That is to say, getting folks openly to talk about HIV, how it was transmitted, what steps they could take to avoid becoming infected. In my own view, that switch flipped when Magic Johnson came out and made his admission. What we need for the opioid crisis is our Magic Johnson. We need something that can galvanize the conversation and really move it into the public's consciousness in a way that people go from saying individuals with opioid misuse disorders should be shunned and stigmatized to saying, they're our friends and neighbors. And rather than putting them in a corner and ignoring them, we need to bring them into the fold and help them. And so it's only going to be when we remove that stigma around the nature of opioid use disorder that we really start making changes in our understanding of it. That's got to be the first task we tackle. It's one of the things that we as an administration are working very deliberately on, and that's when we're going to see the tide start changing.
Representative Holmgren, how much emphasis do you think needs to be on prevention versus helping people who become addicted get access to treatment?
Yeah, I think it's all of these are so important. I would say, you know, we need to do both. So I don't know that you put a prioritization, but certainly if we can keep people from ever trying this, if we can take some steps to make sure that pain medication isn't overprescribed, that people realize the power and danger of this medicine that sometimes they forget is even in their medicine cabinets, and how important it is for us as patients to be very aware of this, that once it's prescribed to us, we're responsible, and we have to make sure that it isn't available where it could get into hands of our kids or grandkids or neighbor kids, something like that, people who might be over at our house. So we've got a real responsibility there, educating young people, educating families, working with law enforcement, making sure that they have resources, Narcan, which really can be a lifesaver for someone who has overdosed. So I don't know that – I think it's all so important, and that's what's difficult about this at a time when there's limited resources. We need everybody to step up where they have spheres of influence. If it is on dealing with someone who is in an addicted position and looking to find a way to get out of that, we need to make sure that they get the care. But anything we can be doing to making sure our young people especially have the information and tools and resources to make good decisions to say, I'm not going anywhere near that. That's the best thing that could happen. And so I think both are extremely important.
Congressman, while I have you on the line, just wanted to ask you one quick question about all the news that's been happening in Washington this week about the Washington Post story. Initially, the President Trump asked then FBI Director James Comey to close down an FBI investigation to Michael Flynn. You know, we've seen other reports. By the way, the White House has said that claim was not truthful or accurate. You know, of course, we've seen the other story this week about the president and whether or not he presented highly classified information to different people within the Russian administration. I know that many Democrats are calling for an independent investigation. Is that something that you support?
Well, my focus and what I'll continue to say as I've been talking to my own constituents and to others is I want answers. I want to get the truth. I want to get to the bottom of this. The two courses would be to have our intelligence committees in the House and the Senate continue doing the deep dive into this that they've already started, or to kind of pull the plug on that and have a special prosecutor do that. Whatever it takes to get real answers, I want to make sure that that happens. My fear is I think time is important. I'm very concerned about Russia. I don't trust them. I don't trust Putin. And so I'm not on the Intelligence Committee, but talking with colleagues of mine, Democratic colleagues as well as Republican colleagues, who really do feel like they're in a position now to be able to do the work, to get the answers, to be able to do the full deep dive research in this and so many other areas that we're really concerned and have very serious questions on.
Can I ask, do you trust the president? Do you trust that he hasn't, do you trust him in terms of presenting information to other governments?
Well, I need more information. I'm concerned about it. We're hearing mixed messages. I'm concerned on both sides of what he's saying, but also some of the leaks that are coming out. And it seems like almost with the leaks where they're one-upping what he said, where they're even giving a little bit more information than what he said, which really does put people at risk. So both sides, it just feels like this is not healthy. It's not good. And so I think on both sides, and again, not being on the committee, trying to get as much information as I can, I'm concerned. I want answers. I know my constituents want those same answers. I want to do whatever we need to do to get those answers as quickly as possible. Right now, I still think the Intelligence Committee is the right place to get those answers and to have real accountability for certainly the administration, but also for those people who are kind of the unnamed leak sources of this information as well, who seem like they've kind of gone even one up of information that has been given out. So a lot of concerns. I think it's not healthy for us. So many challenges in the world. So whatever it takes, we've got to get this figured out soon. And all of us, I think, are very concerned of this and want real answers. I haven't gotten enough yet to make final determination of where I stand on it.
That's Congressman Randy Holtgren. He represents Illinois' 14th District, Northern Illinois, parts of lots of counties, including McHenry, DuPage, Kane, Will. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla. Good to be with you.
I'd also like to thank Dr. Nirav Shah, Director of Illinois' Department of Public Health. Dr. Shah, thank you for taking time to speak with us about this important issue.
My pleasure, Nyla.
A quick update from the U.S. Senate. There's a new bipartisan bill that was just introduced that would expand access to substance abuse treatment under Medicaid. Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois is one of six sponsors of the Medicaid Care Act. That aims to combat the heroin and prescription opioid epidemic by modifying a decades-old policy that limits Medicaid coverage for substance abuse treatment to facilities with less than 16 beds. That proposal would expand Medicaid coverage to pay for up to 40 treatment beds. Senator Dick Durbin says, quote, "By offering treatment for people suffering from addiction rather than simply arresting them or turning them away from help, we can reduce crime, improve health, and save lives. The Medicaid Care Act would help save the lives of so many individuals currently in the throes of addiction." As a reminder, if you or someone you know needs help, the National Helpline for Substance Abuse and Mental Health is 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-HELP. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be talking about a new exhibit at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library in Springfield. It's all about the ongoing baseball rivalry between Cubs and Cardinals fans in Illinois. As a reminder, we love hearing feedback from you. You heard the voicemail we just played. You can always get in touch with us. Leave us a voicemail. Send us an email. All of that information is at our website, 21stshow.org. That's where you can leave us a voicemail. Send us an email. Give us feedback. We'd love to hear from you. If you follow us on Facebook, search for the 21st to like us. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. And if you follow our Twitter handle, our Twitter handle is 21stshow. That's 21st show. During the program, we live tweet with more background and context analysis on what we're talking about. And when we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. Our handle is 21st show. Stay tuned. The 21st continues after this short break.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Chicago Cubs and St. Louis Cardinals first squared off more than 100 years ago. And whether we're talking about a riot at Wrigley Field in 1928 or 70 years later, the much more friendly home run race between Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa, Cubs and Cards is one of the biggest rivalries in baseball. Whether you call it the I-55, the Route 66 rivalry, for baseball fans, you can take a look back at the rivalry. There's a new exhibit at the Lincoln Museum in Springfield. It's called Cubs versus Cardinals, the Rivalry. I'm going to be talking to the creators now. Tom Schieber is a senior curator at the National Baseball Hall of Fame. On the line from Springfield, Samuel Wheeler is a state historian and the director of research collections and library services at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Tom, Sam, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you. Great to be on.
So, Sam, I have to start by asking, are you a Cubs or a Cards fan?
Well, you had to ask me, right? Here in Central Illinois, you're either a Cardinal or a Cub fan, and I grew up a Cardinal fan.
Yeah, that's all right. It's funny because on the 21st, we get a lot of flack because I say we only cheer for Illinois teams, and so we only talk about the Sox and the Cubs, and people get really upset because they say that the Cards is also an Illinois team. Sam, can you explain that?
Yeah, well, you know, the Cardinals, I grew up in Springfield here. I'm only 90 miles away from St. Louis and Busch Stadium. But, you know, even though I grew up rooting for the Cardinals, I'm not a Cub hater. I have really fond memories of growing up and running home from school so I could catch the last couple innings of Cubs games. They were broadcast on WGN, and my brother and I, we loved Harry Carey. He brought such life to the game.
Yeah. Tom, what is it about the Cubs-Cardinals rivalry that makes it unique?
Well, I think there's a bunch of factors that go into that. The you know, there's lots of rivalries in sports and actually outside of sports, but you really need sort of the perfect mix of various factors. For example, you need two clubs that have a long history of their own. Each team needs to have, you know, quite a substantial baseball background. Both clubs in this case do have that. Another factor I think that you need for a great rivalry is proximity. So, you know, here in the Midwest, the Cardinals and the Cubs have been around for a long time, and St. Louis-Chicago rivalry in and out of sports has been around for a long time as well. And you have to have a certain amount of success for each club, and that's the case. I think a lot of people like to focus on the lack of success the Cubs had for quite a while. But quite frankly, certainly very early on, the Chicago National League Club was extremely successful. And honestly, if you look at a real formative time was in the 20s and 30s when both clubs were quite good. And when you got both clubs that have a long history, that are quite good, that are facing off against each other in a local environment, you can really – that's where the rivalry really solidified. And then ever since then, it's just kept on going, whether the Cardinals are doing well or the Cubs are doing well or they're not, you know, you can throw that out the window when the two clubs meet. And so that, I think that's what makes for a unique rivalry.
It makes a unique rivalry, and there's also a common connection. Sam, you mentioned Harry Carey. I didn't know this. He actually called Cardinals games for a while.
He was a broadcaster. Well, I knew him as a kid as the voice of the
voice of the Cubs. Sure.
But
yeah,
you're right. He was a St. Louis Cardinal announcer. And did you also know he had a background with the Chicago White Sox as well?
Yeah. Wow. So let's talk about, Tom, a little bit of the moments of the rivalry. There's a lot of big ones. I mentioned a riot. That was in 1928. What happened there?
1928 riot. Well, so
were there a lot of riots in baseball in 1920? I feel like that was probably a common thing.
Well, you know, I think riot is kind of a strong word, but you know, sometimes when you're playing sports at a top level competition, you're going to get a lot of mayhem going on, and emotions maybe get the better of people. I mean, there have definitely been a number of times when the Cardinals and Cubs face off. You know, the one I think about more is the one in the 1970s when there was quite a bit of chaos in a game in 74 when Al Raboski, I don't know if you remember Al Raboski, but Al Raboski, who's now a broadcaster with the Cardinals, was a very fiery pitcher on the mound. He would psych himself up, and part of his psych-up act was to affect the batter. And
what would he do?
Well, he would go behind the mound and sort of talk to himself and throw the ball into his glove and then just sort of, you know, churn up the mound to the pitcher's rubber in a very ferocious manner. And he had a great
Fu Manchu. Oh, you're in the nickname, the Mad Hungarian, right?
The Mad Hungarian. So he's still around. He's doing broadcasting a lot more calm now. But, you know, he was playing in a game against the Cubs in September of 74, and Bill Madlock of the Cubs got really tired of the shtick, and tempers flared, and eventually what ended up happening was Ted Simmons, the catcher for the Cardinals, ended up punching Bill Madlock, and then, of course, the whole thing went crazy, and it was quite mayhem there.
It was kind of a mound-clearing fight.
It didn't happen a whole lot, but, you know, each rivalry is going to get these moments where the teams just take off against one another.
Yeah, so Tom, where would you rank this? Like, if you would do Sox versus Cubs, Cubs versus Cards for Illinois baseball rivalries, where would you put Cubs versus Cards?
Well, you know, I will ask you guys because I grew up in St. Louis, so I'm a Cardinal fan. But you know, really, is there a White Sox Cubs rivalry really?
Oh, absolutely, Sam. Don't you think so? I mean, well, it's you know,
yeah,
that's a good
bit,
question,
yeah.
Right? Because for Sox fans. Maybe it's more of a one-sided. This is always a question with rivalries, right? Is it sometimes more of a one-sided rivalry or Sox fans more? I mean, I don't know. I guess it's a – I feel like Sox fans won't cheer for the Cubs.
Side.
I'm thinking of last year. I don't know how many
–
there were some Sox fans who were like, I don't care that the Cubs in the World Series, I'll never cheer for them. And then there were Sox fans who were excited, like, oh, it's good that for Chicago. But I feel like that was – I feel like that's definitely a rivalry.
I feel like that the what's missing in that rivalry is they don't play each other very often.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
Only since the interleague play did they play each other in meaningful regular season games, and then the other time was the 1906 World Series they played each other. But I think you need that constant, you know, with the Cardinals and Cubs, they would play quite a few games each year against one another. So that's why I'm thinking of it as I would argue that the Cardinals Cubs rivalry is bigger than the White Sox. Cubs rivalry, and for that matter, for the many, many years that St. Louis had two teams, the Cardinals and the American League St. Louis Browns, there was never a rivalry there either, really. I mean, basically it's because the Browns really were quite bad for a long time, and nobody was really pulling for the Browns very much. So there wasn't much of a rivalry, but also because they just didn't play each other except for that 1944 World Series. So I think you need to have that on the field, a constant play to really feed to a great rivalry.
Sam, what are some of the moments that you guys have captured in this exhibit at the museum?
Well, I was just thinking, as Tom was talking about that All-Chicago World Series from 1906, in our rivalry of the Cardinals and the Cubs, we do have a little moment where we talk about that rivalry between the Cubs and the White Sox, and we have the ball from the final inning of the final game of the 1906 All-Chicago World Series, where the Cubs did not win that World Series. So we captured that one. That's a really interesting moment. But my goodness, if you're a fan of the Cardinals or the Cubs, the memorabilia, the objects from each franchise's past, your jaws will hit the floor when you see what we have on display.
What's your favorite thing
favorite
in these?
Yeah. Yeah, my favorite piece in this exhibit is Stan Musial's 1946 jersey. He did not play professional baseball in 1945. He was serving in the Navy in World War II. The next year he comes back to play Major League Baseball. He captures the MVP, leads the Cardinals to the World Series. And what I've told folks looking at that piece is it's a great, you know, piece of Cardinal memorabilia. Sure. It's a great piece of really baseball memorabilia, but my goodness, it's a piece of American history when you look at the context wrapped around that. And so Stan Musial, probably the most famous, beloved Cardinal ever to play the game. Ernie Banks is probably his counterpart with the Chicago Cubs. We have all sorts of pieces related to Ernie Banks as well. The famous home run chase in 1998, we have a great section in our exhibit devoted to that. So really covering the gamut from Rogers Hornsby and Hack Wilson all the way through the current stars like Yadier Molina and Jake Arrieta. There's something here for all eras of this rivalry.
What kind of things have fans shared with you as the exhibit's been open? It opened in March, goes through the end of the year. What are you hearing from folks who are coming through?
Well, fans have really turned out to see this exhibit. I think we really struck on something that is really interesting to folks here in the area. I have met so many families that have come to our museum to see this exhibit, and mom might be wearing a Cardinal shirt, dad might be wearing a Cub shirt. And so we see divided families. That's been really interesting. I met two gentlemen that were, maybe in their 60s. They were twins. And one of them had a Cardinal jersey, one had a Cub jersey on, and I was talking to them, and they shared with me their family history of the rivalry. Mom was a Cardinal fan, dad was a Cub fan, and that went back, into their childhood, and that's where they sort of adopted this. So those kind of great stories are happening in the exhibit, and we have a place in the exhibit where we ask folks to share with us their best baseball memories. And they share them on Post-it notes. And my goodness, beautiful stories about, family memories that were made at Busch Stadium or Wrigley Field, or just a story of they remember playing catch with their dad as a little kid or coach their little league team, something like that. So baseball, this rivalry, it's a really personal thing for a lot of folks. And so there's a lot of those opportunities in this exhibit to share those pieces with us. And we're not only, putting those pieces on display, but we're actually keeping those in our archive, those little family memories.
Sam, was Abraham Lincoln a baseball fan? I don't think the MLB was around then, but I'm wondering, was baseball kind of a – this exhibit is at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum.
That's right. So what attracted us to this story is that it's an Illinois story. It's an Illinois story in the sense that it is a Illinois citizens are a house divided, right, to use a Lincoln phrase when it comes to their baseball allegiances. But what's also interesting, the very first thing that folks see when they come into this exhibit is an 1860 political cartoon where the political cartoonists use baseball as a metaphor to describe the very contentious election of 1860 in which Abraham Lincoln was elected president of the United States. And, it sort of demonstrates that Abraham Lincoln's rise to political, to the nation's highest office parallels the rise of baseball as America's pastime. And the precursor to the modern game of baseball, town ball, Abraham Lincoln probably would have been familiar with that here in Springfield. We had various little baseball organizations here in town. His law partner was a member of one in 1860. There's all sorts of stories in the White House years during the Civil War that he may have seen baseball being played in the nation's capital. We know that Mr. Lincoln liked sports. He was a good athlete. Wrestling is what we sort of associate Mr. Lincoln with. The question that I get a lot, would Abraham Lincoln be a Cardinal fan or a Cub fan?
Okay, well, we'll leave that as an open question because I don't think you can.
We'll leave that as an open question, right?
Tom, let me ask you, we just have about a minute left, but when we look about, I just feel like looking ahead to this year, right? The Cubs finally have a World Series, right? So clearly not, does not stack up against the number of World Series that the Cardinals fans have to cherish. But what do you think the rivalry looks like this year?
Well, I think it's going to be great. Like I mentioned earlier, you can kind of take whatever the current record of each team is and toss it out the window when the two clubs meet. And that's one of the things, one of the results of having a great rivalry is, it doesn't really matter when these two teams meet. It's all about that game that day. But as it turns out, both clubs seem to be doing pretty well, and it's a pretty even division right now. So, you know, I expect it to go down to the wire, quite frankly. Doesn't seem like anybody wants to really run away with it, but nobody's really bombing. So it probably lasts a long time this season. I'm not sure everyone's going to know what's going to be the final outcome to probably the last day of the season.
Yeah, it's always the great thing about baseball. You never know. That's Tom Schieber.
Absolutely.
He's a senior curator with the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Hey, Tom, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much, Nyla. Appreciate it.
And I want to say thanks to Sam Wheeler as well. He's a state historian with the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. That exhibit is on, the Cubs Cards exhibit, the rivalry, through the end of the year. Sam, thanks for being with me as well.
Thank you so much.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Medill Newsroom in downtown Chicago. Thanks for listening.